In writing about the war on terror, former Monty Python Terry Jones once asked, "How do you wage war in an abstract noun?" He's not alone, of course. Many have criticized the war on terror for being too diffuse and ambiguous a conflict. In his latest book, A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb, Amitava Kumar, a professor of English at Vassar, digs into the amorphous territory of this war and provides a concrete evaluation of the cultural logic behind it. It's published by Duke University Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Amitava Kumar to our show today. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
This book is centered on two men, Hemant Lakhani and Shahawar Matin Siraj. Who are they?
In the case of the first, he is a failed women's clothing salesman who wanted to enter the arms trade. And the FBI informant who contacted him said he wanted a missile from him. The man said no problem. As his lawyer pointed out, in fact, the only thing the FBI didn't ask him for was a submarine, but if they had, he would have said, yes, I can, no problem.
But, of course, he was engaging in illegal activities.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite successful at that. He was not, for example, able to acquire a real FBI, a real missile. And the FBI arranged with their counterparts in Russia to sell him one. And he didn't know how to smuggle it back. But they helped him with that. And when it finally got to this hotel room in New Jersey, they arrested him. So that's the first story. The second story is of interest to me because he's a young man, a Pakistani man, growing up here in New York City. And another informant became his mentor, a man from Egypt who claimed he was a nuclear physicist. And just for better narrative thrill, also said that he was dying of cancer. And then the young man said, yes, he would help him with a bombing, but he had to first ask his mother. 2 to 3 days later, he was arrested and now is spending time in prison. He'll be out 30 years from now.
They've both been convicted in U.S. courts.
Yes, indeed.
Isn't entrapment a sticky defense? If someone invited me to join in a bank robbery, I would refuse. And if I agreed to rob the bank, wouldn't I be guilty of engaging in an illegal activity, even if somebody else was helping me do it?
Yes. But then if I was the one person who was arresting you, if you had said to me that, no, you needed to consult with your priest, I would have some caution about it. Most importantly, I would not, having arrested you, say, we have won the war on terror. The triumphalist rhetoric of those who have made these arrests and also the lack of acknowledgement of the ways in which entrapment has been engineered and also the fact that in many ways the real culprits have gotten away. These are not sufficiently acknowledged and in some ways point to some of the what you earlier called what is diffuse about this whole thing.
Just this Monday, a federal jury found two men guilty of conspiring to attack Kennedy International Airport. Apparently, their plan was to blow up fuel tanks and set off a series of explosions along a pipeline that cuts through New York City. There was also talk of destroying the American economy mixed with suggestions of a ninja-style attack. But they claim also that they were entrapped.
Destroying the American economy? Isn't it already destroyed? And not by terrorists? But right, Leonard, you know, I think there has to be vigilance on these grounds, you know, and there has to be an imaginative approach to these things. But I do not see much imagination here. In fact, informants routinely prop up the plans of people who seem incapable of doing anything real, really damaging, and then waving the flag.
So you're saying people may have these ambitious schemes, and they may be awful schemes, but in the end, they would amount to nothing if somebody else didn't say to them, hey, I can get you those bombs. I can get you those guns.
I'm saying that, yes, partly yes. But I'm also interested as a writer in some of the drama within this. You know, in the latest issue of Guernica, Norman Finkelstein talks about justice of war, whether war is just or not, and justice in war, which is whether people are behaving according to the Geneva Conventions, for example. I'm interested actually in talking about injustice of war, where power is asymmetrical, and therefore I'm interested a little bit in talking about how these people who are the informants and the people who are convicted of crime actually sometimes serve as mirror images of each other.
What sort of message does the conviction of men like these send in the overall war on terror?
The conviction of these men, once we learn that it has been attained through continual surveillance, infiltration through people who misrepresented themselves and who actually made a lot of money through this, you know, informants routinely earning about $500,000, then the first message that is sent, in my opinion, is that you cannot trust anyone in your own community. And I think the U.S. loses its ally, chief ally, and the Muslim community itself when they practice entrapment. That's the first message and the most important message, I think.
My guest is Amitava Kumar. His book, A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb, is published by Duke University Press. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. This isn't the only case of this sort. What was it about Lakhani and Siraj that led you to focus on them in your book?
I started teaching a course called 9/11 Literature of 9/11 at Vassar. And I came across this phrase in the 9/11 Commission report saying that we have to exercise our imagination, that, you know, claiming that the terrorists were imaginative while we needed to bureaucratize our imagination. And I was interested really in whether there had been a failure of imagination in understanding terror and whether we could look at artists and writers who had imagined motivations and actions in a more complex way. That's what led me to this book.
Well, in the case of 9/11, nobody imagined that hijackers would, take over a bunch of planes and crash them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and I guess the White House was the last target. Capital. It just was beyond our imagination, and they were saying we have to start thinking outside the box.
So, yes.
Isn't that what they were saying there?
Yes, and have they done it, Leonard? Do you think they have done it?
No, I think mostly what they do is have me take my shoes off when I go to the airport.
Exactly. Or they have set certain informants who are failed men to look for other failed men, people who are thoroughly compromised in their own lives, and not actually go out looking for those more surprising turns through which terror would arrive at our doors.
So let's talk about the informants in these cases, because the convictions of both of these men hinged upon the cooperation of informants. Did the informants turn them in?
Yes.
And what kinds of backgrounds did the informants, Rahman, was it?
Yeah.
The other one is Elderwoody. What kinds of backgrounds?
In the case of
have?
The first, he was also just like the man he helped entrap, a failed businessman. A string of convictions on fraud charges in this country. And therefore, very much susceptible to threats as well as temptation held out by the government about what he could do or he could get if he entrapped someone.
So the government said to him, you know, we could send you to jail, or if you help us, you might get off.
Yes, indeed.
And actually get paid for it as well.
Quite lucratively, which otherwise he would not even be able to earn, no.
Do you think that the reward system encourages informants to hook in people just so that they can
indeed it does.
Receive compensation?
Yes, most atrociously, yes.
And how generously were they rewarded for their cooperation?
In the case of the first one, about $500,000 and help with the payment of a variety of debts incurred through systematic fraud. In the case of the second,
Elderwoody, who we have not.
He's now living in an undisclosed location under the witness program. I think he's now in California, and
he wasn't a failed businessman.
In his case, his failure. Well, he tried to. In fact, when the FBI first found him, he had ordered a whole load of cardboard boxes filled with clothing, which he had ordered online and hoped to sell them. And a neighbor was alerted the police because they thought there were some bombs here, because they'd seen a Swadhi man with these boxes. And when the police came for him to see what was in those boxes, he said, "You know, I understand your suspicion of Muslims. I want to help you." And that's how he got into this. He wasn't making any money. He was unemployed.
Mm-hmm. But he wasn't engaged in illegal activities.
No.
The way Rahman was.
No.
Who defended Lakhani and Siraj in court?
In the case of Lakhani, he was defended by what I thought was a very brilliant lawyer by the name of Henry Klingerman. In the case of Siraj, there are two lawyers. One of them is called Sean Maher, who actually lives here in New York City and has quite a reputation for getting it, for defending such cases.
Is it difficult to find lawyers who are willing to defend such cases?
I don't know. I haven't tried. So I don't know. But, you know, I was very much interested, Lenny, also in these artists and writers who try to give us a narrative that is different from what is laid out for us in the court. And that is one of where, for example, people become, you know, Cheney famously declared that we needed to go onto the dark side, you know, the day after 9/11. So what these people have done, these artists, and et cetera, have done, they have used the methods of surveillance used by the government to produce art that is now new and different.
Where are these artists working?
In New York City, for example. In one person is out in California at Berkeley who uses the, you know, what he has been trained to do in astrophysics, in astrogeography, to take pictures of distant objects. He uses the same equipment to take pictures of black sites and of those unmarked planes used for extraordinary rendition. And he has gone and photographed the salt pit in Afghanistan just to produce evidence which has not been available to us.
Of course, that gets us into the whole issue of whether somebody should be doing that sort of thing. The debate over the WikiLeaks latest leak. You know, it's easy to take sides, but sometimes it's more complicated than just I'm horrified by what you're doing, and so I have every right to do something that exposes it.
Sure. I think complicated is the right word. I'm in actually favor of being complicated. I'd like immediate narratives that people have when they look at you, when they look at your beard, Leonard, and they assume a certain thing about you. It is precisely that gesture that should be complicated. And these artists?
But they think I'm lovable.
And you are.
I don't want it to be any more complicated than that.
You are. But don't start praying at a petrol pump, because the other day, four bearded men were doing that and they were arrested.
That because they just, was time to pray, and so they put out their prayer rugs and got in trouble?
Yeah, at the gas station, and they got into trouble, yes.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, Charles Ogletree was here to discuss racial profiling.
Sure.
How much of this do you see as being racial profiling?
That's very interesting, because the NYPD released a study where they talk about what are the stages through which young men go through in order to become radical jihadists. And that is an example of racial profiling, because it generalizes very crudely what are the ways in which someone in New York City would become a jihadi. But Raymond Kelly, who has blessed this, was the same person who opposed racial profiling earlier when he pointed out that diverse people who had bombed in the last four major bombings, and then pointed out that there are 40% of New Yorkers, for example, are people from all over the world. How do you profile who a potential terrorist is? So I think it is indeed racial profiling, and it is an inadequate way of approaching terrorism.
Or in the case of the Ground Zero Mosque, is it more religious profiling? Because many of the people who are opposed to having that mosque there say that they're not against having a mosque. They just think that it's an insult to the victims of the 9/11 attacks.
I think that is a case of suspicion and paranoia and fear all mixed together in a dangerous cocktail. Because, and I say all that because I think, first of all, there is a lack of attention to pure details. It's not at the site. It is several minutes walk away from it. Does it have a mosque? Well, it is a mosque. It's a cultural center. It also has a prayer room. So in other words, there are often misrepresentation of facts which mixed in with exaggeration produce these narratives that so many people are eager to embrace.
But it will attract Muslims to the area, and that is...
Well, so far, Leonard, sorry to interrupt, so far it has attracted only the people who are, phobic about Muslims.
When you talk about these things at Vassar, what kind of response do you get?
Oh, alas, my students at Vassar are a rather progressive lot. And I actually have to play the person who is, you know, perversely...
You're the devil's advocate.
Yes, yes. But that, I hope, is your listeners will agree, is the task of the teacher.
Now, before we go to a break, we'll come back with more. You have to explain the title of this book, A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb.
Don't you like it, the length of it? There's complication there, right?
I like
there.
The fact that it's slightly, it's not the way I would have said it if yes. I would have said a foreigner carrying a tiny bomb in the crook of his arm, of course.
You're more poetic. I was
no, more prosaic, I think.
I was following the title. I was taking off from a title by an Egyptian poet whose title was, he's a Jewish poet. He was fleeing Egypt, and his book was called A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Book. Mm-hmm. And in our modern times, in this time, the paradigm of the book has been replaced by the suspicion that the foreigner is carrying a bomb.
Amitava Kumar's book is A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb. It's published by Duke University Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Amitava Kumar, who's a journalist and professor of English at Vassar College. He's written and edited many books, including the novel Nobody Does the Right Thing, which is also published by Duke University Press. He wrote Husband of a Fanatic, which brought him to our show a while back. Also Bombay, London, New York. His latest, A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb. You compare Lakhani's case to the Hollingsworth case. What happened in the Hollingsworth case?
An off-duty federal officer opened a newspaper one day and saw an advertisement for an offshore account, and he was drawn to it. And there, too, there were two people, one a dentist, who were interested in transferring some money offshore and starting a business.
And was it suggested in the ad that this might be an illegal thing to do?
Not at all. It was actually the government agent who put that idea in the mind. In fact, that's why it's the classic case of which ignited the debate about entrapment. And under that suggestion, and again, you know, I've invoked this word before, failure. The failure, you know, our two protagonists there were actually failed people. They had failed in every business they had started. And then the entrepreneurship really came from the federal officer who showed them a way to really make money and then arrested them.
Well, in the case of the Hollingsworth incident, Hollingsworth and Picard both got off. How come were they pretty much using the same defense that Lakhani was?
Indeed, they were. But by the time Lakhani happened, 9/11 also had happened. The issue of entrapment, when it comes to cases like these, becomes very flimsy because you think, well, we can't wait till someone has actually performed the act before we arrest them, because then 3,000 people will be dead. Or at least that's how the argument goes. And so entrapment post 9/11 has become perhaps, you know, I've heard various lawyers in separate cases argue that, but it is not a very defensible thing.
A listener writes in that the Muslim community has failed to denounce terrorist violence. What do you think about that? Do you think that that has contributed to these suspicions?
I think it is incumbent on everyone to denounce terrorism. But on the other hand, making it a mandatory or making it the first response of anyone who happens to be Muslim is actually this is a red herring. Really, it is a way in which people try to assert and argue for every measure being actually legal when they say such a thing. I think people should be asking why, when let's say the 9/11 Commission asks us to be imaginative in our approach to terrorism, why do we not mention how in each of these cases young men are incited by showing pictures of Abu Ghraib, for example? Well, my question is, shouldn't people be denouncing Abu Ghraib in the same way when they ask for a demand for to Muslims to denounce terrorism? You should actually, I don't see a conversation from these people who ask that Muslims be more.
You're saying that a similar situation would be Muslims saying, why doesn't every American I meet apologize for Abu Ghraib?
Exactly. Why don't they, when they shake my hand, say, I'm Leonard Lepet, I'm sorry that Abu Ghraib happened.
Mm-hmm. Or at least go on to the newspapers and say, I'm the head of the Abu Ghraib Forgiveness Committee.
Yes, that would be nice.
You mentioned that one of the people you've written about actually told the informant that he had to go to his mother for permission. Do you think that the immediate families of these young men are in a position to prevent their sons from getting involved? I'm thinking now of John Walker Lind.
Yes. I don't know, Leonard. I must confess that oftentimes when talking to the parents, I felt they were the most... they were victims of denial. I found it tiresome to speak, for example, to Siraj's mother. On the other hand...
Well, what did she say? Was she aware that he was thinking along these lines? Because his thinking was still rather violent at the end.
Oh, of course, of course, of course. No, it would have pleased me, speaking also as a parent, it would have pleased me a great deal if one of the parents I spoke to said, you know, I could see this coming along. Never happened. I have to say, on behalf of Frank Lind, the father of John Walker Lind, whom I also spoke to, I had to tell him while talking to him that I thought it was a great gesture on his part to let his son go. We often speak about multiculturalism in our classrooms. His son, after watching the film about Malcolm X, decided he wanted to be a Muslim. His father didn't oppose him. I find that a little surprising, but also I find it very encouraging that all that we claim really comes here true. And he let him go to the Middle East to study because his son wanted to go and study Arabic.
And some people would blame him for allowing that.
In fact, they called him an idiot and other and worse things. And I'm not in that camp.
Didn't Siraj's family get detained shortly after his conviction?
Yes. I was there that night of his conviction, and within hours they were arrested just before dawn and taken to prison. Even though, as their lawyer explained, they had no real grounds for arresting them. The case for immigration was under consideration, but they were taken and kept for several weeks in a prison in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
The war, and what was the justification for that?
Saying that they had outstayed their welcome in a way. And
they were being punished in effect.
In fact, they were. In fact, they waited for the conviction and then acted quickly.
The war on terror is often framed in very American terms. However, your book looks at how it's affected life elsewhere, particularly in India. India suffered several terrorist attacks over the past few years. Now Pakistan is suffering equally. But in India, there was the Mumbai Stock Exchange bombing in 1993, the attack on Parliament in 2001, and most recently the Mumbai attacks in November 2008. How has the Indian government responded to terrorism?
The Indian government, in a hurry, embraced Bush's war on terror. When the Indian parliament was attacked, our newspapers blared, "This is our own 9/11." In fact, everyone, everywhere in this world, wanting to be Americans, wants their own little 9/11. And unfortunately, several draconian laws against Muslims, against other minorities, were enacted in India. In fact, if we use other examples, Robert Mugabe, for example, arrested people in Africa in his own country, calling journalists who opposed him unlawful combatants, which is the phrase that Bush had used.
And Uyghurs are called terrorists by the Chinese government. And we can go around the world. Anybody who's in opposition to the government, violent or not violent, is called a terrorist.
Yeah, and they all want them to be sent to Guantanamo. It's a popular site. The other thing that also happened was that ordinary people, seeing what was happening in response, wanted to embrace this narrative. You know, I met a guy who, knowing what had been, how Abu Ghraib had been denounced and became a place of shame, actually said that to me that in 1993, the police, you know, so he was rewriting history in his own way, a poultry farmer in India, said that our policemen taught the Americans how to torture because he had seen his own family being tortured.
You mentioned that the media sting is a growing phenomenon in India. What's happening there?
In this country, you are not allowed, only the government, the FBI or the police, for example, can carry out stings. You know, a police officer can pretend she's a prostitute, for example.
In England, there was a sting that was pulled on Mosley, the son of Sir Oswald Mosley, and he won a court case against the newspaper that had done it to him.
Yeah.
But not so in India?
Well, in India, they try to contest it, but it has become really what one journalist called it was an epidemic. In the last few years, with the arrival of television in a big way, every journalist who is being trained as a journalist also has to take a course in sting journalism.
And what do they do?
Well, first of all, they buy a little camera, which is available. You know, there are different prices for different things. And they go and, for example, they go and ask people odd questions or try to do, which often these things are of a pornographic nature, in my opinion. But some other work is splendid. I thought, wow, the last time, the one case that impressed me was when a journalist went and photographed the doctor who would cut off the arms of beggars so that they could get more money.
Doctor was doing this?
A doctor was doing that, yes.
And the government was not investigating him?
No, they didn't.
So it was
they
left to the journalists?
Yes.
What is the Indian government's response to the sting media?
They have been horrible about it. They have, when a website called Tehelka taped various people in the defense ministry accepting bribes, the government, they attacked them with a very heavy hand. And they have, most of the journalists there involved in it have spent about 5-6 years in futile trips to the court.
Hasn't this book also been published in India?
It is.
Is the same basic book?
Yes, and it was titled Evidence of Suspicion.
Would you consider it to be something of a sting operation as far as India is concerned?
You mean the book itself?
Yeah.
No. My own little sting operation, if I might describe it thus, was a visit to an army camp in Kashmir where an alcoholic uncle of mine was the man in charge. And I've written about it in one of the chapters here. And he didn't know what I was doing there. But he didn't also know what he was doing there.
And was he an alcoholic before he went there? Or does being in terrible pressure cooker of a situation make people into alcoholics?
I'm sure he would like to claim that. But no, he was an alcoholic before that.
This may have exacerbated the situation.
Yes. So that was my little sting operation. But the book as such is actually fairly open. I wouldn't honor it that way.
You talked to a number of artists in India.
Mm-hmm. In this country, actually, mostly. But yeah, there was
some. But Arundhati Roy,
yeah, sure.
Who is one of the more controversial writers in India.
Indeed.
Has she been writing about this?
Yes. There are rumors that her a new novel, because she hasn't written any fiction since the time she won the Booker, there are rumors that her new novel is about Kashmir. And I know that she has present at the screening of a film which I discuss in this book, Jashn-e-Azadi, which is a film about We Want Freedom in Kashmir, at various places in Kashmir. So, and she has also written about a man that I hear interviewed for this book, who was a Kashmiri man who was doing his PhD and carrying actually his dissertation in his hand, carrying it to the typist when he was arrested on suspicion that he had blown up the Indian parliament. So she was very vigorous in his defense because they were persecuting him only on the basis of a single scrap of cell phone conversation. So yes, she has been very active and she's also been reviled for that.
Can artists really have much of an impact?
No.
I mean, I guess the last time I heard of a novel actually having any kind of impact was The Jungle, Upton Sinclair, and that was 100 years ago.
Yeah, just a little before I was born. Yeah, no, art or literature has very limited impact. They can't better people's lives. And the same thing holds true for war. But our leaders believe otherwise. And one of the points I'm trying to talk about here in this book, and I know it will not achieve the results I want, is that war is a disaster. Any war is a disaster. The war on terror is a farce and it's a disaster.
How has Bollywood been treating this story? Is it similar to the way Hollywood does?
Bollywood has been defending India against terrorists for a long time now. You know, and
with musical numbers in the
middle. Musical numbers. But I'm always touched by something. While you guys are good at, or Hollywood is good at demonizing the other, Hollywood tries to damn them by just humanizing them. You know, so they are more complex portraits, But in the end, they are still people who can be done away with. And so your hero or your heroine might fall in love with the terrorist. And then at the end, they must, of course, remove themselves from this planet by pressing a button.
Of course, you wrote this book before this recent film was made, in which a journalist finds a fake Osama bin Laden.
Yes, Tere Bin Laden. Yes, I haven't watched it, Leonard, but I'm glad.
Well, it's been banned partly because it's been seen as inflammatory.
Yes, it's been banned in Pakistan, I thought. But you heard it's banned elsewhere also?
Well, I think wherever they thought it was going to cause trouble.
Have you been watching a bootleg version?
No. Yes. I don't speak Hindi, and would that be Urdu? I don't know.
Yeah, a mix of it. Mm-hmm. A mix of it, yeah. But if I come across it, I'll tweet about that to you.
You spent some time in an Indian army camp. What do Indian soldiers think about all of this? Their attitudes be similar to American soldiers about the war on terrorism?
I did not see the display of as many naked women bodies as you do in the pictures of American army camps. But other than that, the main thing that struck me, especially when I visited what is the only psychiatric unit in Kashmir, was that more and more of the army soldiers are ending up there. I think of them as caught up in a drama that is so much bigger than them. They are almost all of them, displaced provincials in many ways. You know, they're from small towns. And they have come to a place, they thought they're serving a big cause, but where they have gone, they are called dogs. They go out of their camps and it says, "Go back, Indian dogs." And it causes an acute schizophrenia in their minds, in my opinion.
Why is Kashmir so important for India? After all, to an outsider, I'm not going to talk about all of the bombings and the like,
sure,
but to an outsider, it did seem like India was in the wrong here. The people were mostly Muslims. They would have preferred to, if there was going to be partition, to be made part of Pakistan. And it was only because the ruler was a Hindu that it wound up with India.
Yeah.
And to this day, there has been resistance to a plebiscite.
Sure.
It's at a cost of millions of billions of dollars, because it also has led to India's nuclear policy.
Sure.
All for a scrap of land, maybe a beautiful scrap of land, but a scrap of land that where most of the people hate the Indians as occupiers.
Because I have a beautiful wife and two lovely children, I don't want to go on air and say we should give up Kashmir because, you know, this will be dangerous to my health. But
you want to be able to go back to India.
Or at least home to Poughkeepsie. I actually think that we are, you know, Indians, because India has treated it it's an army of occupation in Kashmir. So I think there we are clearly in the wrong.
But it has led to terrorism in the area.
Indeed. Militarization and war leads inevitably to terrorism, and that's something that the Americans should also learn from their experience in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Just one more thing. You said that you don't really think that this book is going to change people's minds. So why write a book?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I
we have very 30 seconds for you.
I don't think
we
can end this on a note of silence. But, because I think it's still important to make a statement. I don't think one can reach into the minds of those who are fanatically opposed to you. But I would like as any artist must, the picture of reality should be shown in a slightly different light always. And that's why I'm doing this.
Of course, you could have written it as a novel and been treated quite differently.
Yes, but you know, Duke
and maybe
has
more
also,
seriously.
I don't know. Duke has already published the novel too, so which has also an element of terrorism. I urge your listeners to buy both the novel and the nonfiction.
Amitava Kumar teaches at Vassar. His book published by Duke University Press, "A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb." Thank you so much.
Thank you.